You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 4th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to The Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, dozens dead, hundreds injured in a chemical attack in Syria. The White House calls it reprehensible, but will the West actually do anything? We'll also hear from a reporter who joined Donald Trump's Secretary of State on his recent trip to Turkey.
You know, let there be no mistake, just so we can be clear, there is no space between Turkey and the United States and our commitment to defeat Daesh.
There's an ambitious project to blast through millions of tons of rock to build a huge shipping tunnel in Norway. We'll learn more about it later. Plus, the Dutch news site paid for entirely by thousands of readers that's now eyeing a launch in the US. Later on, we'll learn about the latest in aircraft interiors and we'll find out why hundreds of cinemas are screening the same dystopian drama today. That's all in the next hour on The Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. So a busy hour ahead of us. Before we begin, let's have a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. Investigators in St. Petersburg say the explosion on the city's metro may have been a suicide bomb. A suspect has been named by authorities in Kyrgyzstan. 14 people were killed and nearly 50 others were injured in the blast on a train as it travelled between two stations. A senior aide to the former US President Barack Obama has rejected claims that she ordered the surveillance of Donald Trump's campaign. Susan Rice, who was National Security Advisor under Mr. Obama, has described the claim as absolutely false. She's also rejected an allegation that she leaked information about Mr. Trump's security advisor, Michael Flynn, who had to resign over conversations he had with the Russian ambassador. South Africa's powerful union federation has said that the country's president, Jacob Zuma, should stand down. The head of COSATU says he is no longer the right person to lead the country. Mr. Zuma is under growing pressure after a cabinet reshuffle triggered South Africa's international credit rating being cut, which has itself put more pressure on the country's economy. And a rare diamond has sold for a new world record price of $71 million. The Pink Star is an oval-shaped stone, the largest ever found, of almost 60 carat. The auction in Hong Kong lasted only 5 minutes. The buyer was a jewellery retailer in the territory. Welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. At least 58 people are now known to have been killed in an apparent chemical attack in Syria. Many more were injured in the strike on Khan Shaykhun, with the White House calling it, saying it is confident that Bashar al-Assad's government was behind the attack, a claim that Syrian officials have denied. Some groups have claimed that the nerve agent sarin was used. It is 20 times more deadly than cyanide. The attack has drawn condemnation from around the world, but so have past assaults in Syria, only to be followed by little concerted action. So what will happen this time? Well, joining me in the studio is Tim Eaton, who's the project manager at the Syria and its Neighbours Policy Initiative at Chatham House. On the line from Washington, we have Natasha Lander, senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and a former advisor to the US government on chemical weapons. Tim, let me begin with you. We mentioned in brief the latest there, but what do we know so far about this attack?
Well, I think the details are still unfolding, but certainly as we know that scores are dead, hundreds are injured from this air attack. Clearly, the speculation is of the agent involved. Is it sarin? That is, in fact, the same agent that was used in August 2013 in the infamous attack in eastern Ghouta, just outside of Damascus, which prompted great talk about red lines and red lines being crossed, and which resulted in a deal being struck between the US and Russia over the decommissioning of Syria's chemical weapon arsenal. Now, there have been many chemical weapons attacks that have taken place in Syria, perpetrated by the regime since that point, but they have used the agent chlorine, which has not been included in the definition of chemical weapons to the same extent as it also has industrial uses. This, however, would be a direct contravention of that deal, and not only contravening a deal that the US signed up to, but also Russia, the principal backers internationally of the Assad regime. So if this is in fact the case, which remains to be proven, the consequences are unclear.
Natasha, let me turn to you, because Tim mentioned that attack in 2013 when it's thought that more than 1,000 people were killed. And after that, the alleged crossing of a red line, Syria was supposed to have got rid of its chemical stockpiles under supervision. If this is another sarin attack perpetrated by the Syrian government, then obviously that operation didn't work.
Well, I don't know that I would say that it didn't work necessarily. The U.S. government was able to remove quite a bit of chemical stockpile from Syria with the help of a broad international coalition to include Russia. And so I believe that, while there may have been chemicals that were left in the country, there certainly, I don't know that I would characterize that operation as a failure necessarily.
But it's hard to characterize it as a success when the exact same chemical may have been used by the exact same government in the exact same way.
Right. I think that's absolutely true. And I think, it's really a question of looking at the motivations behind why a country would want to use these sorts of chemicals or these sorts of weapons. And I think, to look to a country like Russia, who does have a military presence in Syria, it's very important to consider why they haven't spoken out in the same way as the U.S. government and other governments throughout Europe as well about these attacks. I think that's certainly something to look at.
Tim, the White House today called this attack reprehensible and very strong condemnation. But it's only a few days ago that the U.S. said that it was no longer prioritizing regime change in Syria, that was no longer stated aim of U.S. policy. Did that give a green light to Syrian government forces that it suggested, well, we could do this without any kind of consequences?
Well, I think one of the big debates over the course of the Syrian conflict has been what impact Obama's talk of red lines and the Russia-US deal over decommissioning chemical weapons has actually had. Many in the US in particular contend that the removal of those chemical weapons is a success in US-Syria policy. But many who look at the Syrian angle of this say it's been a resounding failure, because in fact what it did do is it gave a carte blanche to Assad to use anything but chemical weapons in the regime's repression of the opposition. And in fact, what we've seen there is really the US betray its baseline over what it was willing to give up to intervene in Syria. And I think that the regime has pragmatically read those tea leaves and used all of the force that it can. And actually, perhaps what today really indicates is that if indeed sarin has been used, that the regime has very little fear of any form of sanction from the West for its actions. And when we look at what the White House and various elements have said today, we see Sean Spicer restating effectively that regime change is not the option it once was. We see Trump blaming the Obama administration for not following through on the red line. And then we see Secretary of State Rex Tillerson essentially asking Russia and Iran to pressure Assad. None of these indicate a muscular response.
And this is very reminiscent of that red line issue from 2013. And as you say, although, yes, there was this operation to get Syria to get rid of its chemical stockpiles, in the end, nothing really changed. In the end, Syria continued launching chlorine attacks. Now it may have stepped up to sarin. Is there any will, whatever the outrage and the fury today, do you think there is any actual will on the part of powerful Western nations to intervene as a consequence of events like this?
No. In short, I think talk of boots on the ground in Syria is political kryptonite in many ways. The only element of the conflict for which you can see greater involvement, I think, really is in the fight against the so-called Islamic State. We've seen, obviously, deployments of US troops to bolster Syrian Democratic Forces, led Kurdish-led forces in the northeast, and on that front. But really, when we're looking at the use of the regime's air bombardment against the opposition, it's the opposition in which I don't think the Trump administration holds any real faith. Clearly, there is a fight between various elements of the opposition and an ongoing battle by Al-Qaeda-linked elements to cannibalize other elements of the opposition. And really, I think it's very difficult to foresee the US administration lending significant support to an opposition where it feels that there's a significant risk that its support could go towards supporting Al-Qaeda-linked elements.
And Natasha, do you feel, I mean, Donald Trump's administration has talked about wanting to step up its involvement in operations against Islamic State, while at the same time saying that removing Assad is not really its priority anymore. Is this attack going to change that?
Well, I think certainly any Middle East strategy that is being pursued by the Trump administration must take into consideration the continued chemical weapons attacks in Syria. We've also seen evidence that ISIL has used chemical weapons in Iraq and Syria. And so I don't think that you can discount that. And I think particularly when combined with this latest incident, it's very hard to ignore. I mean, it was about 3 years ago at this time that we saw the first incidents of chlorine use by what we now believe to be Syria, and what the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and the UN's fact-finding mission has since proven that the Syrian regime has conducted attacks such as these, and has also proven that the Islamic State has conducted mustard attacks as well. And so I think that any comprehensive strategy to counter ISIL and the wide range of things that they are capable of needs to include provisions for countering chemical weapons use as well.
What provisions, though? Because as we say, we had an international operation to remove this chemical stockpile. This wasn't supposed to be something that could happen again. So if that hadn't eliminated the risk, what could the international community do this time that would be different?
Well, Tim raised a good point about, chlorine not being considered a chemical weapon. But the Chemical Weapons Convention does also include provisions that say any chemical that becomes weaponized, that is a violation of this treaty. And so the use of chlorine the way that it has been used is certainly a violation. I believe that the OPCW has done well everything within its power that it can to enforce the Chemical Weapons Convention and also to ensure that allegations of use have been investigated to the fullest of their ability. The missing piece of this puzzle is what we can do in the international community that can uphold the sanctity of those treaties. You saw recently that a UN Security Council resolution that would hold perpetrators of chemical weapons attacks in Syria accountable was blocked by vetoes from Russia and China. And so certainly that dealt another blow to the international community's ability to counter the use of these weapons. So I think perhaps individual sanctions against members of the Syrian regime, the way that the United States government did in January, might be more effective and targeted than trying to get additional UN sanctions. But I also believe, too, that the OPCW must be a loud and consistent voice when it comes to preventing and, speaking out about the abhorrent use of these weapons. You mentioned the red lines issue, which is certainly a politically unpalatable thing for many countries to try and consider when it comes to ramping up military action. And so I think that would have to be considered very carefully, but certainly with some of the military action that's already going on in Syria, there has to be some consideration there for how to deal with this issue as well.
Tim, lastly, let me just pick up this one last thing, that however appalling the pictures that are coming out of Syria, however appalled international governments may be, at the same time there's a meeting in Brussels talking about whether or not countries will be willing to provide aid to Syria for reconstruction with Assad still in power, which implies that major Western democracies will be willing to supply financial aid to a country led by a man who this week is killing his own people with chemical weapons. That's a fairly extraordinary position for major Western democracies to be in.
It is, and certainly a very uncomfortable one. But I think when many countries, particularly in Europe, European countries, look at their the options in front of them in Syria, they see few good military options, certainly, and believe that the area of most leverage that they hold is economic. So clearly, the conference and the EU's efforts to try and exert some kind of economic leverage over the bill for reconstruction in Syria is seen as one angle to pressure the regime. But it will be a very tricky angle to play, because the regime will also be very clever in seeking to get money in and support its allies locally in the reconstruction process. So it's going to be very difficult to provide large amounts of funds for reconstruction without a large amount of those funds filtering into the coffers of a regime who's perpetrated the crimes that you've just mentioned.
Tim, thank you very much. Tim Eaton is the project manager at the Syria and its Neighbours Policy Initiative at Chatham House, and also Natasha Lander there, a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, of course, any international action that would happen on Syria would need support from Turkey, the country on Syria's northern border and the one that has taken so many refugees from the conflict. But how willing is Turkey to work with other countries? Last week, the US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson went to Ankara, where Turkish ministers complained about US support for Kurdish fighters and demanded the extradition of a Turkish cleric living in the United States. Well, Nick Wadhams, foreign policy reporter for Bloomberg News, was on that trip with Mr. Tillerson, and he's on the line now. Nick, Mr. Tillerson was full of praise for Turkey during his meeting, saying how close they were on issues like dealing with Islamic State, but he didn't exactly get a similarly warm response.
That's right. There was this sort of extraordinary moment on stage where he was there with the Turkish foreign minister, and the Turkish foreign minister really sort of went after the United States on this cleric Fethullah Gulen, who's in the United States, who Turkey wants extradited, on the U.S. Support for the Kurds and its willingness to partner with the Kurds in the fight against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And Tillerson, in sort of what's clearly becoming his, an emerging style for him, really just completely shrugged off all of these basically attacks on the United States and on his department and the policies that the administration is implementing in Syria, and just said, we're focused on the good things and we believe Turkey is an important ally in the fight against the Islamic State, and just sort of went on from there. It was actually quite an extraordinary moment.
But these are some big issues. Turkey has been going on about Fethullah Gulen for years and really stepped it up after the aborted coup last year. They view the YPG militia as a direct threat and so want the US to drop that support. You can't just pretend forever that those divisions exist.
Well, I mean, this is one of the great challenges that Tillerson is going to face, because Turkey is a NATO ally. It is hugely important in terms of its, its geographic location. Also, the fact that it hosts an air base where the U.S. Has a huge number of planes and even allegedly some tactical nuclear weapons. So the United States basically has to decide how willing it is to get what it needs out of Turkey and in some ways coddle Turkey and put up with these things while also being true to the principles that it would seemingly cherish as a democratic society and also as a society of laws, where Secretary Tillerson has been explicit and the previous administration has been explicit that, the matter of Fethullah Gulen is a case for the courts. That's for the U.S. judicial system to decide. You know, in Turkey, where judicial system is increasingly coming under the power of the president, that's not really an argument that holds much water.
As you say, Turkey's a NATO ally. It's in a strategically vital position, but it's being run by a man who is becoming increasingly authoritarian. What do you sense is the U.S. attitude to Mr. Erdogan?
Well, you know, I think they're willing to play ball. That's the sense I get. I mean, my impression when I spoke to people about this, having witnessed that moment in Ankara, you know, and obviously this is a story we've been following closely since the coup, when a lot of the language out of Turkey really hardened. You know, there are a lot of things the United States would wish that Saudi Arabia would do differently, for example, or some of the Gulf states, Bahrain, not a really stellar human rights record there. But these are things that the United States, you know, like other countries, to be fair, is willing to put up with in the furtherance of other goals. This is sort of a hallmark of Rex Tillerson's time in just his couple of months in office. He says, you know, the goal here is fighting the Islamic State. So the impression we get from speaking with him and his aides is, I am going to do what's necessary to fight the Islamic State. And these other things, yes, we think they're important, but they're going to take a back seat to that goal.
But isn't the point of the big democracies like the US and indeed the UK that they are supposed to be able to gently shift countries like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia, towards greater openness and democracy, and not just say that they're willing to look the other way?
Yeah, I mean, this is really one of the fundamental issues we're seeing in the Trump administration, and particularly with Rex Tillerson. He is not championing these things when he goes out in public with these leaders. So he is not condemning Turkey's human rights record when he's standing there. He's not saying anything about the referendum and the U.S. view. He's not meeting with the opposition when he's there. And we know from speaking with people around Tillerson that this is something this is how he views foreign policy very differently from John Kerry and some of his predecessors, who really championed human rights and believed that it was the U.S. role as a leader, allegedly on some of these issues, to champion these things publicly and to box in both allies and adversaries, to provide that example. Rex Tillerson is different. He thinks what he wants to do is have, allegedly what he says is he wants to have these conversations in private with these people. In public, he says he's conscious of the fact that they have audiences that they need to appeal to. And if he's coming and appearing on their turf, he wants to be courteous to them. You know, we have yet to see whether this will work or not, but that at least is the strategy he's putting into play.
Nick, thank you very much. Nick Wadhams from Bloomberg News. You're with The Daily from Monocle 24. Still to come, how do you blast through millions of tons of rock to build a tunnel for ships? Plus, we'll talk to two cinemas joining a global screening today of a dystopian classic. Do stay with us.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We're going to talk next about the launch of a new online news site in the United States. Now, your response to that maybe, well, so what? That's the kind of thing that happens every week or two. But this is a little more interesting than normal. Die Correspondent launched in the Netherlands in 2013. It carries no advertising and instead is funded solely by its members, 56,000 of them, who each pay the equivalent of a little over $60 a year. Now it wants to set up in New York. And Jay Rosen is helping them. He is a professor of journalism at New York University, and he joins us now from our New York bureau. What is so appealing about their model? What is it that's got you so interested in it?
Well, I think they've optimized for trust in the sense that not only do they have no ads and no targeting and no tracking, but they also have a very tight relationship between their correspondents, their writers, and their readers, who provide a lot of knowledge, contacts, and information that make the journalism better. So it's the combination of the involvement of the users in the journalism And the economic model of relying on readers to support the journalism that has me interested in helping them jump the Atlantic and come to the U.S.
There are obviously challenges in trying to make an impression in a market as big as the U.S. It's very different to the Netherlands. Is there room for an operation like this to not just get by, but to grow and to thrive?
There are a lot of challenges, and I think it's going to be very difficult, but it's worth a try because we have the demonstrated model in the Netherlands to work from. We are experiencing a kind of crisis in trust in the U.S. media market. There's a need, I think, to sort of go back to roots, to build up the relationship between readers and writers, journalists and publics from the ground up. And yeah, I think there's room. It's going to be difficult. I give it no better than even odds of succeeding, but that's not a bad bet.
I suppose there are potential disadvantages, too, from the membership model, that you are reliant on the sole income stream. If you have a cover price and you also have advertising, you also have advertorials and all of these kind of things, then there are lots of different income streams coming into the business. If members start to lose interest and memberships tail off, then the whole enterprise is in immediate danger.
That's true. In a way, you're betting everything on the journalism and the journalists and the editors. And that's another thing that I think is appealing about it. It's like an existential bet. And sure, it's not as solid a foundation as a three-cornered stool or advertising subscription and sponsorship. But I think that is what makes it a kind of starting over in the relationship between journalists and citizens.
Now, you're leading a research project into this membership model. I mean, do you think that it is scalable to other larger organizations?
We don't know yet. We're going to take a year to study all the different membership models that have risen up in news in the U.S., in North America, in Europe as well, and see what can be learned from prior attempts to base a news organization on membership dollars. But it's not simply that members support the organization with their money. They also support it with their time, their knowledge, with sharing the reports themselves, and feeling involved, feeling represented by the journalism. And can it scale? I don't know yet. That's a good question. That's one of the reasons we're trying this. We're trying to learn from it.
I'm just wondering, when you said about optimizing for trust, how much that is about not having advertising? Because in the old days, a big newspaper like the New York Times would have rather proudly said that they had a sort of a Chinese wall between the department that sold the advertising and the department that handled the editorial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the digital era, though, that is increasingly not the case. When you have to attract advertisers, you're always thinking about who you're targeting with your journalism, which groups you're appealing to. And I think not having advertisers frees you in a lot of different ways. It's not just that you don't come under direct pressure from them. It's that you don't have to worry about all sorts of things. For example, having a constant flow of new articles and stuff and content that can possibly sit next to advertising. So getting rid of the ads gives you a kind of a new lease on life. And if it can be done, I think it should be tried.
It's a fascinating experiment. It'll be intriguing to see how it works in America. Jay, thank you very much for joining us. Jay Rosen there from New York University. You're listening to Monocle 24. Next to Norway, where work could begin next year on the world's first ship tunnel, a huge project which would involve blasting through 7.5 million tons of rock. It would take up to 4 years to complete. It would cost close to £100 million. Joining me in the studio to help explain all this is Hannes Lager, who is the Director for Infrastructure at ARUP, working on immersed tunnel projects in Scandinavia. I mean, this sounds fascinating and also almost impossible. How do you go through 7.5 million tons of rock to build a tunnel, and why would you?
Blast it. That's the answer. Just blast it out, make a big opening, and make it ready to go a ship going through. This is how it works.
It sounds potentially massively dangerous.
I wouldn't say it's dangerous. You know, we're building tunnels for the last 200 years, like 200, 300 years. This is what's the easiest way to do a tunnel. It's like put some dynamite in it, load it up, blast it out, make a big hole, and this is how it works. We've done this for years and years to come. It's about safety. It's about how you do it. And, you know, we are used to doing big tunnels like this around the world.
So is it just a question of scale that you would do a railway tunnel would be smaller, a road tunnel would be bigger, and a tunnel big enough to get commercial shipping through?
That's exactly what it is.
Bigger still.
That's exactly what it is.
Does the challenge increase with the size of the tunnel, or is it just a similar principle?
It's a similar principle. I'll give you a really good example. One of my last projects I did was in New York, where we built on the Upper East Side a 28, 29-meter span cavern under big skyscrapers in New York in exactly a similar rock. We blasted it out, and I tell you, we go to New York, and when you blast a big, big, big tunnel in New York, it's very exciting. This is a project in the middle of the countryside, in a fjord. No one is around. You blast a big hole. It's really about the basic principles, how to build the big tunnels. So we've done this for a long time. It's not really a big deal. But yes, it's a very exciting project because we're putting a ship through it, something which has never been done before.
I mean, a few years ago, we were seeing for the first time big commercial ships heading sort of north across the top of Russia because the loss of Arctic ice meant that you could actually navigate that channel and come into Europe that way. The implication of this goes well and it works and it's not that expensive comparatively is that every time you meet any kind of a movable object for shipping now, just put a hole through it.
Pretty much what it is. Yes, exactly. But, you know, the reason why they build it right there, like when you look at the topography where Norway is right there, right? So this is a big peninsula out in the ocean. And what happens on this around the peninsula, you have really, really strong current and winds, right? So it's about a 10-hour journey to go around this peninsula. So building a 1.7-kilometer tunnel straight through a very, very good rock, it makes totally sense to do it because you cut about 6 hours of your journey. You take, you know, losing a vessel, like it's not about the monetary thing, but, you know, losing life obviously is a big thing. But using a vessel is, what, 50, 60, 70 million. This tunnel is probably, what, 240, 250 million pounds. So economically speaking, totally makes sense to do it. Technically speaking, not that big of a deal. I think we can do this. I think it's a really value project, and I think it's really exciting for a tunnel engineer like me. A ship tunnel? How exciting is this?
As projects get bigger, and here in London, obviously, we're coming to the end of this huge Crossrail project to drive this tunnel under the whole city, east to west, to run trains through, which I think is next year. The trains are supposed to be running through it.
Correct.
Do you learn things from that project that enable you to then say, right, well, the scale of that project means that we can apply this in another way to another equally big project, like building a tunnel big enough to get a ship through?
Absolutely. This is lessons learned. You know, we learn by experience. And, you know, just to come quick back to London, there's actually a bigger project in London right now. We're building a big sewer tunnel through London, which is actually bigger than Crossrail, which just finished hopefully next year. And I think it will. It has huge merit to London. But we have a bigger project now in London. And London is a great example of this. Every time we do a project in London, we learn a lesson, we move on to the next thing. Project gets better, gets cheaper, gets faster. And this is exactly what happens in Norway. This size of tunnels have kind of been built before. And, you know, it's technically absolutely feasible. Honestly, 50 years ago, we would have said, ooh, big project. Today, I would say, hey, cool project. Let's go forward and do it. And it's a lessons learned on these projects constantly.
As you say, in a way, it's almost simpler. I watched one program about building a Crossrail that showed at one of the big interchange stations, they were having to drive the tunnel through, sort of like threading a needle between the existing underground train tunnels within, you know, a few meters. And if they'd gone a few meters wrong, then they would have come crashing through the roof of one of the tunnels. As you say, this is a big bit of rock, nothing in the way. So in a way, it's almost easier.
It's still not easy, you know,
easier.
It's easier. Yeah, it's still not easy. But the great thing is today, technology has moved forward. We have more innovation. I think we get much cleverer as well. We have more engineering. We get better educated. I think projects like this are getting better, but of course, they're getting more complex because we're actually trying to push the envelope much more and more and more. But I think we're learning a lesson from all these projects from before. So I think this is what happens in my field of engineering. So jobs like this in Norway, awesome, exciting. We learned the lesson. Let's be excited about it.
You've called it awesome, exciting, and cool in our conversation. So I have to quickly ask you, once it's built, would you like to go for a journey through it?
Of course I will. Not that I'm excited about going to a cruise ship, but I would go for that and go through the tunnel, absolutely.
It'll be a curious cruise to go on. Hannes Lager, thank you very much for joining us there from AddUp. You are listening to Monocle 24. Now this week, the Aircraft Interiors Expo takes place in Hamburg. The show opened today, carries on until Thursday. To get a preview, a little earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall caught up with our contributing editor and transport expert, Tristan McAllister, who began by asking what sets apart the exceptional aircraft interior from a more regular one.
You're talking about everything above the wing, and that's sort of how the industry talks about it. Is this particular exposition that happens in Hamburg every year is the sort of go-to event for everything interior related. So let's think about that. What would that mean? Well, it's the hard product, which is everything that you would get on an airplane if you turned it upside down and shook everything out of it. The things that would stay, that's the hard product, but it's also the soft. So it's everything from service to pillows. So just the sort of the ephemera that go along with it. Now, sometimes it's essential, other times it's not. But we're talking about things as miscellaneous as fire retardant shoes for flight attendants, which is a thing and in some cases required.
I wear them all the time in case
of
anyway.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I'm sure they would look very nice on you. It's sort of all-encompassing. So one hall, you have great catering from all the big aircraft catering brands in the world. And in other halls, you have fire retardant shoes, as I've said, and then airplane seats. And so everyone in the world who works in the aviation industry, who's looking to outfit a jet in the near future, goes to this exposition and says, what's next? What sort of makes a good standout and what makes a great standout? That's a good question. I think it varies by part of the world. It also varies by class of service, and it also varies by airline. You know, some low-cost carriers don't put a whole lot in their cabins. That said, they do need to pay attention to how their safety manuals look, and people go to this exposition who just specialize in making safety manuals. So you literally find everything at these interior shows. And it's very interesting to see, just because you don't realize how much goes into it, but also, you know, the magnitude of the regulation around the industry. Everything needs to be fireproof. Everything needs to be tested. Every seat needs to have been sat in or shown to take wear and tear well over a course of time. And these products get to market. They've actually been in existence for a number of years. So the innovations we're seeing today actually won't be in jets for another 5 or 10 years. So we see virtual reality systems at these shows. The idea of maybe distracting people while they're sitting on a jet, making them think they're at a beach so they don't know that they're actually crammed in the back of a jet. We see those systems. We know that technology is available today, but implementing it, testing it, putting it on these jets, it may take a number of years.
That's the thing, isn't it? I visited a company that supplies in-flight entertainment once for a story from Monocle, and I was surprised to find that with the technology systems on board, as soon as you can get on, say, what feels as a brand new jet on its first flight, but that technology itself is already maybe 5 years old because they have to put in the order so early, don't they?
Right. And they oftentimes order it in bulk. So, for instance, you know, I work with a client, working with a client recently, they ordered 30 some jets, right? Well, they have to buy the technology for the in-flight entertainment systems in bulk. They save a lot more money. So that means they buy all those systems at one time, and they put them in a warehouse, and then they standardize it across a fleet of jets that roll out, you know, over the course of a year or two. So, you know, there is always this lag. And then on top of that, you have to test it. What I, you know, one of the things that I found out recently, and I hadn't known this, was that look at your in-flight or your Wi-Fi systems on your jets. The reason why a lot of airlines haven't adopted those things so fast is because most airlines have to test those Wi-Fi systems themselves on their own jets. They have to take a jet out of service. They have to spend a month or two with it, figuring out where to put the antenna, getting that antenna's placement approved by aviation authorities, then figuring out how to wire the jet internally. And so you figure out the cost of these things is so great, so massive. Airlines, of course, want to make these investments, but they can't do it all at once. And those are the things you sort of see at the expo. It's fascinating because you go, okay, well, this new technology exists for the actual in-flight Wi-Fi to work and be fast, but airlines have just now caught up to the original sort of generation 1.0 of Wi-Fi systems. And now we're seeing it at something like this expo in Hamburg, these new generation systems. But airlines have to go back and retrofit their whole fleet to sort of bring that all up to date. So there's a lag on it.
And so tell us about what the clientele at these events is like. I mean, is this the kind of place where you could go up and pick up some one-off interesting decoration aesthetics for your own private jet? Or is this more major carriers looking for fleet-wide enhancements of how their planes are going to operate for their customers?
I think generally this is a commercial aviation proposition, but, you know, and there are expos for private aviation, but you still see the sort of spillover. A lot of these companies work in both spaces. The big OEMs like Boeing, Airbus, Bombardier, they do make commercial and business versions of all of their jets. So you can see elements of those things at these shows. But, you know, and I think, too, sometimes private jets are big. They do take the systems that a commercial jet would. Mm. So there's definitely overlap.
Monocle's contributing editor Tristan McAllister speaking there to Tom Hall. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, a political crisis continues in Paraguay over plans to allow the country's president to seek re-election. Crowds gathered outside the Congress building peacefully this time after earlier protests turned violent, culminating in the killing of one 25-year-old demonstrator. The president, Horacio Cartes, wants to overturn a constitutional rule which bars re-election. Well, we can get more now from Monocle contributor Declan McGarvey, who normally monitors the region from Buenos Aires, but this evening joins me here in the studio. Declan, that bar was imposed after the end of Paraguay's dictatorship. That was nearly 30 years ago now, but clearly a lot of people in the country feel that it's still important.
Yes, that prohibition was introduced in 1992, 3 years after the fall of the Stroessner dictatorship. Its imposition was symptomatic of what historically is a fragile democracy in Paraguay. It has a history of dictatorships, and its imposition was just after the Stroessner dictatorship, which had lasted for some 35 years and was known for its brutality. It's to protect against this happening again in Paraguay. And what these protests are about now is this potential change to the constitution, which is being pushed through by the ruling party, is stoking fears of a new slide towards authoritarian rule and possible dictatorship.
Now, there aren't many countries that have a one-term limit. There are lots of countries that have a two-term limit, like the United States. What reason is the president giving for wanting this change?
Right. So Horacio Cartes, the president of the ruling Colorado Party, is so far running a fairly successful presidency in terms of economic growth. Paraguay, over recent years, has enjoyed some of the highest growth rates in the Latin America region, which is bringing some changes to Paraguay, which is historically one of the poorest countries in the region, has poverty rates of some 35%, 20% of the population live in absolute or extreme poverty. Now, Horacio Cartes, from his perspective, is saying that a second five-year term is necessary in order to keep pushing through these pro-business, pro-market reforms that he's doing in order to keep what he says Paraguay going down the correct path towards further economic growth. His detractors, his opponents are saying that this is a creep, a slide towards not only standing for re-election in 2018 next year for one further five-year term, as you gave the example of the United States, a second term, that one of the fears is that this will give way to potentially unlimited re-elections. And going back to the example of Alfonso Stroessner, who ruled Paraguay between 1954 and 1989, one of the strategies he used to be able to do that was to continually modify the constitution in order to allow him to stand again and again for election, for re-election. So there is a fear of that happening again. And just in the last 10 days, such things as a state of siege being declared by Horacio Cartes in the face of these protests, putting tanks and military troops onto the street, seeing backdoor deals being done in Parliament before it went up in flames over the weekend during those protests, and secret votes being taken place in Parliament under the auspices of the ruling party to see this amendment being pushed through is really raising the fears of ordinary Paraguayans who have Stroessner very clear in their collective imagination, if they were old enough to live with it, those of a younger generation who grew up within a democratic period in Paraguay, you know, they would have been told about the evils of Stroessner by their parents and grandparents, and they too don't want to see that change or potentially go back down that route.
As you said, that the protest turned violent. There was a death of one protester. A police officer is now facing charges over that. Since then, there's been this offer of talks on this. How is this likely to be resolved?
There is this offer of talks. It's likely to be a very tough negotiation. I think one certainty about this is that the President Horacio Cartes is very unlikely to give up his plans to see this amendment go through Parliament and then see it subject to referendum. He's been at this a very long time. This first surfaced in August of last year when the amendment was attempted to go through Parliament. It was defeated, but it didn't go to bed. It wasn't put to bed. Horacio Cartes has brought it up again in the last couple of months. There's been lots of negotiations going on behind the doors. It's been pushed through by a closed-door vote in Parliament between the ruling party and an opposition party, which is not really doing its job in terms of checks and balances on the executive, which is one of the major disappointments of the Paraguayan people. It's symptomatic of failings in democracy in Paraguay at the moment. Democracy isn't really working. And then it goes subject to referendum if the amendment is passed. Now, remember, Horacio Cartes is leader of the Colorado ruling party, which has ruled Paraguay for 66 years of the last 70 years, and in fact was Stroessner's party as well. So they tend to do very well when it comes to national votes. He's from a businessman. He's from a business background, owns some of Paraguay's biggest companies. He's used to getting his way. He's used to making executive decisions. He's used to making people listen to him. Clearly, he has some kind of strategy that he's seeking to force through here. But that strategy directly clashes against the popular will, at the moment at least. When it comes to referendum...
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is apart from the protesters, how indicative their protests are of the wider public opinion.
Right. At the moment, it seems that the protests are mostly being participated by middle-class Paraguayans, who have the greatest concerns about constitutional values in Paraguay, have most concerns about the slide back towards a possible dictatorship or authoritarian rule. But they will, in a possible referendum, come up against a very strong Colorado party, which is the natural party of power. Also, polls at the moment are showing that some 80% of Paraguayans are against this idea of a constitutional amendment right now, 1 year before national elections, and being pushed through by the incumbent in order to somehow prepare himself for the next elections as they come. But polls are also suggesting that a majority of Paraguayans are in some ways favour of allowing a two-term presidency at some point in the medium to long term,
this way,
as it goes through long discussions through Parliament, through both houses of Parliament, and within a public sphere of openness and transparency, which isn't happening at the moment.
We'll have to leave it there. Declan McGarvey, thank you very much for joining us. You're with Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
But it's time now to take a look at some of the stories making headlines across Asia. My guest in the studio this evening, Ramón Pacheco Pardo, is a senior lecturer in international relations at King's College London. Thanks very much for coming in. Let's start with a piece in the Straits Times about the famous
Singaporean mathematics teaching method, which is apparently making great inroads in the UK.
It is. In the past, it did in the US, and now it has reached the UK. Apparently with very good results. So the teachers and the students who have been following this method report a much better understanding of maths. And also, it seems that students are happier because it is more child-friendly the way maths are being taught.
The child-friendly thing is interesting because I think the traditional view of Singaporean teaching methods is it's all a bit hothouse.
It is, that's true, that's the traditional view. But actually, when it comes to maths, the starting point is looking at objects, not necessarily studying the concepts, which is the last point where this style of math teaching actually gets you. So by starting with objects, kids actually visualize what math is about, and then they can understand the concepts. So in a sense, it's actually a little bit about Singaporean soft power, because it changes perceptions about how Singapore teaches its own kids.
I have four beans and I take away two beans, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I'm quoting an old sitcom.
let's
move on to this meeting between the mayors of Seoul and London. What was this about?
Well, the mayor of Seoul did a tour of Europe and he finished in London. He wants to boost Seoul's credentials as a cultural capital. Obviously, London is considered to be one of the most important cultural centers in the world. They were also talking about issues such as climate change, diversity, employment rights. It has to be said that Seoul mayor used to be a human rights lawyer during the dictatorship, so he has a history of defending those that were oppressed by the South Korean dictatorship. And it seems that he's changing Seoul, and he sees London as a potential model for what Seoul might become in the next few years.
Interesting also that the government in Seoul and the Greater London Authority are going to work together on things like environmental projects, low carbon. I know there's a lot of talk in London at the moment about really much bigger charges on people, say, who drive diesel cars, being charged quite a lot of money to come into any part of London. Is that something where there might be a lot of experience they can share?
I think that's part of the idea. Also, Seoul has been boosting public transport over the past few years. It wants less people to use their cars. And obviously, London, as we know, less and less people are doing the same. There's cycling, for example, that Seoulites are starting to do. Seoul is 10 million people, London some 8 million people. So these are really big cities and they can make a real difference.
Now, we were talking a little earlier in the program about an aircraft interior expo. Fascinating news out of Cathay Pacific. Alarming news, if you're what we might call one of a large gentleman, that the seats are going to get smaller.
They're getting smaller, and believe it or not, this has been the most read and the most shared story in Hong Kongese media over the past 2-3 days, actually. This is what Hong Kong's people are talking about. They're going to squeeze in extra seats, and this has created a stir, because some people say, well, if you cannot afford to fly, you shouldn't be doing this, because the idea is to have getting prices cheaper. But some people are saying we have to democratize flying, so we have to introduce the extra seats and more people can actually fly overseas.
Now, they are actually saying that this is going to deliver a great in-flight experience by making the seats smaller. Now, I am I'm looking at a 14-hour flight next month. I don't want a smaller seat. I don't care how big the entertainment screen is. That's a comfortable seat.
And that's the point they're making. A smaller seat, but bigger entertainment screen and Wi-Fi. So you can actually use Wi-Fi all the way to wherever you have to go.
I suppose the challenge for an airline like Cathay Pacific, as you say, they want to democratize it and make it available to people who previously might have thought they couldn't afford it. But in some respect, you diminish the flying experience of people who could afford it beforehand anyway.
Yes, and this is the big discussion. I think that's why it has made top news, because many Hong Kong people are saying, well, Cathay Pacific used to be one of the top airlines in the world, and they feel that this is actually going to make it go down the rankings and not be able to compete with other airlines. And that's actually a big concern for the government and for the Hong Kongese people.
Ramon, I'm nervous about that 14-hour flight now, but thank you very much for coming in. Ramon Pacheco Pada from King's College here in London. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Today is the 4th of April. Now, firstly, dear listener, you've left it too late now to send me my birthday card, but it's also the day that Winston Smith begins keeping his secret diary in George Orwell's 1984. Well, today, hundreds of cinemas are screening the film adaptation of that dystopian book as a protest against Donald Trump. Well, the idea came from Dylan Skolnick, who's from the Cinema Arts Centre on Long Island and joins me on the line now. 1984 is obviously one of the most famous books in that dystopian genre, but what made you decide to screen it now?
Well, it's a book that clearly has a deep resonance at this moment. I mean, the book is a bestseller once again here in the United States, long after it was originally published. And the issues it raises are very much at the forefront of everybody's minds here in the United States.
Now, are most of the cinemas screening this in the U.S.?
The vast majority are in the U.S., but we do have... I think about five in Canada, one in England, one in New Zealand, one in Croatia. So, there's 200 theaters altogether, and more than 190 of those are in the United States.
Is Donald Trump Orwellian in the way you would think of Big Brother, say, in the book? Because, of course, in the book, they succeed in managing all information and pulling the wool over more or less everybody's eyes. There's only a very small number of people who are fighting back. But when Donald Trump speaks, most people assume that it's probably not true.
Well, there are many people who do that. And, you know, he's certainly a sort of almost a comic version of Big Brother, one might say. But still, you know, the issues that are in the novel and the film about, the denial of facts, the idea that there are alternative facts, that, you know, the demonization of foreigners, the creation of a surveillance state, all these are real issues, and they should, you know, we want to start talking about this now, not wait for things to get bad.
Dylan, thank you. Well, one of the cinemas taking part in the screening is the Avon Theatre Film Centre in Connecticut. Adam Birnbaum is Director of Film Programming there. Adam, how much interest has there been in the screening?
The interest has been quite substantial between film exhibitors themselves who jumped on board to participate and lend their venues to this cause, in addition to the feedback we've been getting, which has been that number of cinemas have sold out in advance of the screening. Some have even added screenings today for turnout.
And what happens to any proceeds from them?
You know, that's a great question. Because this is an informal network of independently owned and operated cinemas, it's up to each venue to make that determination themselves. We did not compel anybody to do anything specific with the proceeds. We did make suggestions as to different charitable causes that they might consider, but ultimately it's on a venue by venue, case by case basis. Some have decided to link up with charities that are either national organizations or perhaps more local charities and organizations in their communities. In the case of the Avon, we are going to be earmarking all proceeds to be utilized for future educational programming endeavors that will underwrite the cost of tickets for students in the local public schools to be engaged in the next film screening that we do with them, since we do a great deal of programming in the community for students.
At the risk of playing devil's advocate for the sake of it, I just wonder, as a form of protest, whether this is effective. I mean, I personally love the film adaptation of 1984, but I imagine that everyone who goes to a screening is probably someone who's already come to a relatively fixed negative view of Donald Trump.
You know, I think that's a great question. And to that question, I would say two things. That first and foremost, I think it's more than just tonight. And if, in fact, there is a uniform point of view that's represented in those seats, that perhaps people will be galvanized in some way beyond this evening's program to leave that theater and think of ways to proactively engage with other individuals, with their local officials or government on a broader national basis, to try and facilitate change and to continue to object. I think it's very important to keep it at the forefront of people's minds that they need to remain proactive and that they also shouldn't just feel a sense of hopelessness.
Adam, thank you very much. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but thank you to Adam Birnbaum there from the Avon Film Centre in Connecticut, and before that, Dylan Skolnick. That is it for this Monocle Daily, produced by Tom Hall. Our researchers are Jolene Goffer and Alexis Sogol. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Ty Genwright here in 8 hours' time for The Globalist, 7 a.m. London time. The Monocle Daily back at 2200 in London tomorrow. For the moment, though, from me, Paul Osborne, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.